I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The hands of Chiefs quarterback Patrick Mahomes are good for more than just throwing touchdown passes. He recently lent his skills off the field to construct homes for veterans experiencing homelessness. Success at the Veterans Community Project even attracted visits from three different Democratic presidential hopefuls. Today, could the Kansas City startup create a positive ripple effect on homelessness nationwide? Then we learn about the magical power of mushrooms. Not only do they literally clean the world around us, but they can aid in medical treatments and could help build new economies. It's a close look at fantastic fungi. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Not long ago, on a single night in January, nearly 38,000 veterans were experiencing homelessness, 38,000 across the country. Well, the Kansas City-based Veterans Community Project is trying to eradicate homelessness among veterans. It's doing it through their now well-known Tiny Homes Project. The organization continues to expand across the country, too. This year, it's headed to Longmont, Colorado, Cincinnati, St. Louis, and Orlando. With us here to talk about the Veterans Community Project is Josh Henges. He's the director of the Veterans Community Project Kansas City, and he's one of the speakers at this year's sold out, it's always sold out, TEDxKC 2020 that'll take place on February 5th, unless the Chiefs Victory Parade postpones that date until later on this spring. Josh, nice to have you. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Let's begin with an overview here. How big a problem does this country have when it comes to homeless vets?
Yeah, it's pretty big, and that the point in time count is interesting.
Yeah.
Most social service providers will they'll extrapolate that a little more. It's tough to count, but the the wisdom is it's that number times three. That's usually what you find.
Wow.
Yeah, and we love the point in time count. It's a good chance to get some kind of working knowledge of the problem, but it's often much bigger than what we're seeing in those counts.
So more than 100,000 would be the number that might be operative here.
Yeah, that's pretty much anyone who's doing this job on a real level, that's what they're going to see.
Is the number going up, Josh? Is it going down? What are we seeing?
Well, over the past 3 years, it is going up, and it's going up in all facets of homelessness.
Meaning what?
Yeah, so whatever efforts that we're putting in place to get the number to go down don't seem to be working. And there's a lot of reasons that could happen. One of the things that happens when it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, when you create homeless services, homeless people flock to those places. And then when those places are overrun, they don't have enough beds or places to put them. That's when you see this uptick. So eventually it will level out. It's just we're in a period of growth right now for homeless folks. But people are really trying. They really are.
So the Veterans Community Project stepped in to fill this void. When did it begin? When did it start in Kansas City and why?
Well, it started, it was based out of a couple things. So there's a lot of frustration with how the system currently operates. There are massive gaps in the system that don't catch a lot of hardcore homeless folks. And the other gap is they don't catch all veterans. So most veteran serving agencies, they don't consider you a vet unless you're VA eligible. And there's a lot of qualifications that go into that. At VCP, we serve anyone who's a vet. So if you serve one day in the military, we consider you a veteran. And it was in response to these gaps in the system that this was created. And it's kind of two ways, especially when you're working with vets. They don't believe in excuses, right? Mm-hmm. But they don't believe in them in two ways. So the first program that VCP started was our bus pass program. So we work with the Transit Authority. They've been an incredible partner to provide free bus passes for every vet.
I was going to say, it's free for the vets.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And I love what Mayor Lucas is doing to making it free all the way around. We are so for that because it removes the excuse of I can't get there to an appointment. But it also removes the excuse from the social services provider of, hey, he can't get here, right? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of two ways. That's what really got us on the map. But the goal was always housing, and the goal was always housing in a very unique way. Congregate living, there are positives and negatives to it.
Meaning groups of people living together.
That's right. Mm-hmm. what I found, and I think most people can agree to this, there's a lot of healing that can take place when you finally have a place of your own. And in the group setting, you kind of become the group. And it's important to be around community, but community is really important when you're when it's done on your time, mm-hmm. in your own way.
So why tiny homes? Where did that idea come from?
I think it's...
When we talk about tiny homes, we mean really tiny homes.
Yeah, they're 240 square feet. Mm-hmm. They are... It's in wide open floor plan. So when you're in there, it actually feels bigger when you're in it. We invite anyone to come out. We do tours all the time. We love showing them off. Tiny homes, it was a couple things. This is a community-wide problem. And if you really want the community to buy in, they need to be interested in the thing that you're doing. And this community, Kansas City, is deeply concerned with this problem, and they're really concerned with vets. And tiny houses is something that people can get behind. They've seen the big, you know, the big buildings, the big apartments, and there's not a ton of buy-in for it, but they bought into this, and that's one of the reasons.
I want to point out that tiny homes are only one part of what your organization does, Josh. What does VCP offer the veterans that it serves?
Yeah, the tiny houses are incredible. We have 49, and obviously that's not going to house all the vets in this area. But we have an outreach center. We saw, I believe it was 3,200 vets last year in our outreach center. And we provide the basics too, like food and hygiene, things like that. But those are just a means to get to what's causing this person to need those items. One of the things we want to do is prevent homelessness. And we will prevent probably 5 or 6 times as many people as we house from becoming homeless through our outreach center. So we have a great partnership with the VA, who offices out of there a few times a week, and Goodwill Industries offices out of there to help with job placement and job readiness skills.
How popular have the tiny homes, to go back to them for a minute, how popular have they proven to be for the veterans themselves?
It's game changing. It's life changing. When they open that door, it smells like a new house. And everything in that house, they get to take with them when they move. And they know that. So right when they walk in, there's ownership of this thing. And it's something they haven't felt for a while. And honestly, it usually takes about 2 weeks for them to get out of survival mode. And after that 2-week mark, they start opening their doors more, opening their shades more, talking to their neighbors. It's really cool to watch.
Wow. I can only imagine that tiny homes aren't for everybody, or am I wrong?
No, they're not for everybody. Mm-hmm. A lot of folks, just in general too, but with the homeless population, they need to be in a group setting. It's the thing that helps hold them accountable. It's the thing they want. Sometimes the tiny house is just too small. A lot of folks, let's say you have a hobby that requires you to have more space. Well, that's what they want, but it's a good starting point for a lot of folks. For me, my stepdad always taught me you can only be in one room at a time. So why do I need a big house? And that's kind of something I've carried my whole life. So I really resonated with this.
Can you put a face on this issue for us, Josh, and tell us about a veteran or two who live in your tiny houses and maybe something about their story?
Yeah, and I have permission from her. Her name's Karen, and she's done a lot of media. When we started this thing, she was among the first 13, and I went up to her and I asked her, if the media were to come, can we use you to tell your story? Because when you think of veteran, you often think of a man, and we'll never have to advertise for that. Everyone's going to kind of think that, but they don't usually think of a woman. And she said, I will step up and I will be that voice here.
Wow.
She's been incredible. She fled domestic violence. When you flee domestic violence, you're signing up to lose everything. And that's what she did. When we met her, she had done that. She wasn't even trying to struggle. She was tough. She wasn't going to let it get her down. And she's been nothing but success. And she's about to move into a 3-bedroom house in the Independence area. We're super proud of her.
Is she a veteran?
Yeah. Veteran of the Coast Guard. She was stationed in New York. It was a long time ago, and she's had quite a journey to get here.
Mm-hmm. Now, VCP is privately funded. Why, and what's the advantage of that?
The advantage is we're really nimble. So federal funding, although you can get a large sum of money federally, it comes with a lot of strings, and those strings create the gaps in service.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that private funding does is it connects you to the community. When you're getting money from the federal government, you're excluding this area to be a part of the solution.
Hmm.
Kansas City wants to solve this. They want to partner with this. And being privately funded, you directly connect with the people who want to end homelessness with you.
So where's your money coming from? Who's making donations to make these homes possible?
Well, it's individuals. That's a huge one. We have a lot of corporate philanthropy. Mm-hmm. That's been an incredible source. And then private foundations.
Mm-hmm. You said you have 49 tiny homes now. What's the goal?
Well, for Kansas City, we're okay right now for Kansas City. Obviously, if we had an endless supply of, you know, oil money, if we started a casino and could fund more, we would. But right now for that location, 49 is good, but we're expanding across the country. We will be constructing houses in Longmont, Colorado this spring. Mm-hmm. We have the location, we have the land, and we have the plan. And then seven more cities by 2022, and a few of them that we have that are, we're pretty sure that this is where we're going to go, Cincinnati, St. Louis, and Orlando, and that'll be in 2020 as well.
It's exciting.
Yeah, it's exciting. It's hard. It's really fun. Everyone at VCP is so pumped to come to work. It's a hobby and a job. It's incredible.
Well, what's the average stay for a veteran in one of your tiny homes? Do you see this as being years, or is it something different?
Yeah, it's a couple things. So our average stay is about 220 days. What you want with folks who are experiencing housing instability is you want 18 consecutive months of stability. And when you hit that mark, there's about a 90% chance they'll never become homeless again with the right supports. Hmm. So that's what we want. So even
why 18 months?
That's just what the data shows.
That's just the number.
Yeah. And I think it really comes down to being able to create a routine and a habit and being okay with success. So when your normal is chaos, you got to get used to no chaos. And that's one of the things. Even when they transition, we stick with them for about 12 months. We just want to make sure that there's stability all the way through.
Tell me about that chaos that their lives are, because I imagine that for a lot of people listening, that's a hard concept to grasp.
Yeah, it is. When you see the person holding the sign or a homeless person as you're on the plaza or whatever, think of this, 80% of homeless adults were homeless as kids. So that person most likely was homeless their entire life or experienced long bouts of that.
I saw that stat in the documents last night. That's an amazing number to me.
It is, and it kind of puts into perspective. So even when you feel, because when you engage with a homeless person, even when you look them in the eye, sometimes we avoid it because you carry that sadness with you, right? Or you might be frustrated. Why is he asking me? Think of that person as a little kid, and it kind of changes the way you feel about them.
Hmm.
Yeah.
80% have been homeless, you're saying, for most of their lives.
Yeah, and I spent a long time working with homeless youth, and the number of homeless youth, it dwarfs the number of homeless adults in this city, too. So there's a lot, and that's the fastest demographic of homelessness is families with children. So those families, it's tough to get traction, and when you can't get traction, ultimately what can happen is you become homeless again.
Hmm. You know, to what extent are veterans, have they heard about Kansas City? They've heard about the tiny homes. Veterans who might live farther away, are they migrating to Kansas City to take advantage of this new possibility in their lives?
Yeah, so we get calls from VAs across the country saying, hey, can we send this guy here? Can we send this woman here? And what we want to do is we've got a problem here we want to solve. So importing veterans here, it doesn't serve what this plant, this location, mm-hmm. this community is for. So we try to avoid that. We try to help them fleece wherever they're at, their network of support. We've had people hitchhike from Vegas, from Atlanta, from Chicago, wow. just to get here. And we've helped them. But our focus is right here in Kansas City right now.
Was one reason that VCP started here, Josh, was it because that Kansas City's homelessness problem among its vets was more profound than other communities around the country?
Yeah, it's a couple things. That's a really good question. We have a personal connection because we live here. It is bad here. But the services are really good here, too. The VA is an incredible resource, and they really care. They've got new leadership. And from top to bottom, their desire to really connect with this community is it's never been like this before.
Huh.
So it makes sense. I mean, this city wants to end homelessness. I mean, it's true. I'm not just saying that. Kansas City is committed to this, and that's a big reason why it's working.
You know, eradicating homelessness among vets, I believe, is your goal. How possible is that, and how close are you to it now?
It's possible. It's a logistics problem. It's so much cheaper to end homelessness than to keep people homeless.
What is it? I saw that too. What does that mean?
So on average, it costs about $40,000 to keep someone homeless. So that's emergency services, shelter services, hospital stays,
right,
rehab, things like that, where the recidivism rate is incredibly high.
Right.
And if you think about how much does rent cost for a year versus $40,000, you know, and that's dollars and cents, but you also need to back end a lot of support with folks. But most folks, 80% of homeless people are homeless for 2 weeks or less, and they're never homeless again, right? So you got 10, so you want to go all the way to 100, you got 10% who are chronic roughly, and then you got 10% who might become chronic. So in that 20% is where the hard part is. That's where the cost is. So we can really work with this 80% very quickly if we're just committed to housing them right away. Mm-hmm. They don't become the chronic, and the problem begins to solve itself.
Do you see a day when we will have eradicated homelessness in Kansas City?
100%.
Yeah.
Without question, it will happen.
Within 5 years, within 20 years, what is it?
I think definitely within 20 years. But if we're committed to it, the way the agencies in the city and the people in the city, when we get the right people in leadership within this system in Kansas City, we could end it within 10 years. Truly, wow. We really could.
To what extent has Kansas City become a model for other communities based on the experiences you've had here in town?
That I don't know. It's because, you know, it's kind of... You don't think of yourself as that, mm-hmm. you know, even as a city. But the way we can partner with federally funded agencies as a privately funded agency is the thing I really believe that people are going to latch onto, because mm-hmm. they'll see the value in jumping in between those gaps instead of fighting it. And anytime you go into a new city, you're the, you know, who the heck are you? You know, are you the cowboy saying we haven't solved our problem? And you can eradicate that real quick and say, all we want to do is help.
Yeah.
We are here for it.
Yeah.
But we take the best of this country and say, let's try and do that. Like places like Utah, Toronto, Portland. I mean, they do some amazing things.
Have the Longmont, Colorado people, for instance, that you want to expand out there this year, have they been to Kansas City to see what we're doing here?
Yeah, and that's how it started. A developer mm-hmm. came out here, saw the property. I actually gave him the tour. His name is Kevin Mulshine. He's an incredible man. He saw what we were doing. He said, I got to take this back. And he met with the city, and the city said, let's do this.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Why Longmont, Colorado? Is there a particular problem there?
Yeah, there is. It's a suburb of Denver, and as you're driving, it feels like the city never stops from the airport to Longmont, but it is. And it's an interesting mix. There's a high density of veterans there, and there's a lack of services in that area. And there's a commitment from the city saying, we've got to figure this out quickly.
Yeah. We're talking about eradicating veterans homelessness in Kansas City through the Kansas City-based Veterans Community Project. I'm visiting with the director of the local project. That's Josh Henges. I read that your fascination with homelessness started when you were 5 years old.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
This is 100% true. It's the first time I remember seeing a homeless person. My mom and I were on Broadway driving. And it was
here in Kansas City.
Yeah, right here in Kansas City. It's where the Kauffman Center for Performing mm-hmm. Arts is now.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't there. It was this rocky, vacant field. And I saw someone. He looked completely it made no sense to me. And I asked my mom, like, what is that? And she tried to explain it to me. It's a homeless dude. And I'm like, there's literally empty houses in our neighborhood. Like, how does that make any sense? And she did her best to explain it, but it confounded me. It made no sense.
Wow. When you were in college, your passion for the issue only grew. Why? What was happening there?
I don't know, man. I was just obsessed. And using the parlance of, I was chasing the dragon, man. I got a hit of homeless when I was 5, and I kept chasing the dragon.
That's amazing.
It's all I ever wanted to do.
Yeah. Hey, how long has this country had a homelessness issue with its veterans?
Since the Civil War.
Since the Civil War.
Yeah, if you go back and look, it's really interesting how it happened. But since then, it's Groundhog Day. It's similar problems, just a different time. But the way we are choosing to fix the problem is getting better. We will get it right. It's going to take the right people in leadership to do it, though.
You know, I know it goes without saying, but there's something just so wrong about the idea of a homeless veteran.
Yeah,
it just hits you, and it doesn't feel right.
Yeah, and I think that's why the community is saying that we got to fix this problem. And I know with the community support in this area, we'll be able to fix it in every aspect of homelessness, every demographic.
There are people who still think that these people should be able to pull themselves up by the bootstraps. I mean, they're veterans. They've been through all kinds of stuff, and they might even say that about themselves sometimes. But you've said it doesn't work that way. Why not?
Yeah, generally it doesn't. So usually the first thing you say is, do you think they want to be homeless, right? So They usually don't. But something is keeping them there. Now, and one of the things we always say is, it doesn't matter who knocked you down in life. It's you that's got to get up. But you can also help someone up as well. Like, but ultimately, you've got to get up. So that idea of just pulling yourself up by the bootstrap, I understand where they're coming from. But if they could, they would. So you're talking about folks who have...
And that's a hard idea for a lot of people to wrestle with, whether it's mental illness, homelessness, these other scourges of our society.
Yeah.
And people look at someone who can't get off the couch because they're depressed and they think they're just lazy. And it's just not that simple.
It's not that way at all, especially folks who've undergone trauma. And it's the same demographic with veterans. They are the same demo. So it's chaos when they're little. The military may have stabilized, but because they're used to chaos and the military can kind of give you that, they get discharged and all they know is chaos. The demographics are the same. Those are the same kids who are homeless as little. When they're little, homeless as adults. It's mm-hmm. the exact same. So one of the things I like to do is I'll give someone a menu that's either in Greek or Chinese. And I say, can you read that? Because they always say, can't they just get a job? I'm like, can you read this menu? No, I can't. Okay. That's the same thing as handing this job application to the person.
That's a great analogy. That's
teach them how analogy. To do it. We'll
yeah.
do it together, right?
Right.
They want to get off the street, I promise you. They just got to get the right resources.
You know, you said, Josh, that the inability to really understand this issue is one of the big problems here, and it's one reason why the issue endures. Explain that to me.
Oh, I'm sorry. Will you say that again?
Well, just this idea that we have a hard time understanding this problem and why people are this way, and that's one reason why the problem endures.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it's that same thing. So the pull yourself up by the bootstraps is kind of half the population. And then the other half, they kind of have a fantasyful idea of homelessness, and they really want it to be comfortable for them because they have empathy. Empathy is a good thing. So here's some cash. Here's a blanket. Here's a tent. But both of those things don't end homelessness mm-hmm. on their own. So it's kind of this tension between those two worldviews that kind of create the persistence of this problem because those two worldviews infect the system in which homeless people are supposed to negotiate for help.
Mm-hmm. So what's a typical day for you like?
It's fun. It starts bright and early. First thing we do is we meet with the team and we talk about what's going on with all the vets that are there. And then walk-in folks start coming into the outreach center. So we're helping them. We're doing basic case management. We got to do a lot of grant writing. We love anytime the media gets to come by or we get to come here. It's one of our favorite things to do. Got to lecture at UMKC yesterday. So you just kind of never know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, speaking of people you like to have come by, you've had a few presidential candidates drop by.
Yeah.
Who's been out to see you?
Mayor Pete, Kamala Harris was out. A couple senators from Missouri and Kansas. We haven't had Charisse Davids come out, so if anyone out there knows her and wants to get her come out, we'd love to meet her.
Have her come see us.
She is yeah. amazing. I used to train jiu-jitsu with her.
Is that right?
Yeah, she's tough and real. She's amazing.
I bet she's glad to have that endorsement from you. That's Josh Henges, director of the Veterans Community Project Kansas City. He's one of the speakers at this year's sold-out TEDx KC event. It's scheduled for February 5th, might be put off with the Chiefs Victory Parade coming up. Josh, really great to have you. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you so much.
After a short break, we'll come back and talk to you about the magic of mushrooms. And I'm not kidding. You aren't going to believe what this is all about. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Win or lose on Sunday, the talk of the town in my newsletter will be all Chiefs. Go to kcur.org/Kraske and subscribe to Kraske Off Mic. You'll get updates on the shows you missed and a weekly column from yours truly. Sign up now. Just go to kcur.org/Kraske. On Monday, Super Bowl fever will still be in full swing, but the Iowa caucuses are also happening. Yes, the process of picking a Democratic presidential candidate is about to begin. We'll hear from a political scientist who spent a lot of time up there and learn what to expect going forward in the primary process. That's Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, you thought the only thing mushrooms could do is look good on a steak or maybe boost a salad. think again. Turns out that mushrooms are just a visible part of an organism known as mycelium. And mycelium can do all sorts of things, from cleaning the environment, killing termites and bed bugs, to actually making our immune systems work a whole lot better. And who knows, it might offer a path forward when it comes to the treatment of Alzheimer's disease. Author Michael Pollan describes mushrooms as the frontier of knowledge. Well, the latest film, directed by Lewis Schwartzberg, documents all of this. It's titled Fantastic Fungi, The Magic Beneath Us, and it's one of the few films to receive a perfect rating on Rotten Tomatoes. One reason is the jaw-dropping time-lapse photography that Lewis employs. He's part of this year's TEDxKC event. He joins us now from Studio City Sound in Studio City, California. Lewis, nice to have you. Welcome.
It's great to be with you guys.
A perfect rating on Rotten Tomatoes? I mean, how does that feel? Because that doesn't happen very often, Lewis.
Well, I think people are connecting to the fact that we all want to, you know, feel nature's intelligence. And that's all about being interconnected to each other. In nature, you know, communities flourish, ecosystems flourish when there is cooperation. And that seems to be, I think, the need we all feel as communities. So we're I think, mirroring what is below the ground, above the ground.
How in the world did you get interested in mushrooms?
Well, I started shooting time-lapse cinematography when I graduated from UCLA. That's back in 1974. And the reason why is, two, one, a sense of wonder to see things move, making the invisible visible. The other reason was I wanted to shoot 35-millimeter movie film, which was very expensive, $100 a minute. But in time lapse, you shoot like one frame every 10 minutes. And so you're able to shoot a very small amount of film over a long period of time. And that turned me on to shooting flowers. And when you film flowers, you realize that, you know, plants are critical for our survival. And then I did a film, Wings of Life, for Disney Nature, narrated by Meryl Streep, which is about pollinators, bees, mm-hmm. bats, hummingbirds, and butterflies, that gives us the food we need, which is critical for human survival. And then you have to ask the bigger question, what do plants need? They need soil. Where does soil come from? Well, it comes from the mycelium network. They can decompose organic matter. They can break down rock. And most people don't realize that soil is a living, breathing, immunity envelope that wraps itself around the earth. And without soil, there'd be zero life on our planet.
And this network that is below us in a forest, for instance, sort of mirrors what a computer network looks like. Am I seeing that right?
Absolutely. People jokingly call it the Wood Wide Web. it is a network under the ground that connects trees to one another. So it's really a beautiful model for us because it's a shared economy where nutrients are shared below ground so that ecosystems flourish. So a mother tree will take care of its seedlings, its baby tree. One tree will feed another. It's a warning system. If a tree or a plant is being attacked by a parasite, it can send a signal to another tree to beef up its immunity system. So it's a beautiful model, and it is like the internet. I mean, basically, it's an archetype that exists throughout the universe. I mean, there are cells. Cells form branches. Branches become networks. I mean, look at your human body. You got the circulatory system, your nervous system, right. The brain.
Right.
They all look visually similar as the mycelium network does underground.
And we're just starting to get our arms around what in the world this network is all about, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the third. First of all, most people think mushrooms are a plant. They're not. It's its own kingdom. Six times more species of fungi than there are of plants. Under, you know, every footstep in a square cubic foot of soil, there's 300 miles of mycelium. And wow. So we're just wow. beginning to understand the complexity and the life force energy that is literally under the ground beneath us. But what we are learning, which is really important, is it can help with cleaning up an oil spill, you know, bioremediation. It can help with our bodies. It can help with, you know, breast cancer, Alzheimer's. It basically wants to heal. And it wants to kind of put things back in the right order. And we need to really learn a lot more about it.
That's where I was going to go next here, is how in the world can fungi save this planet?
Well, for example, what they do is they break down organic matter. So if you have an oil spill, for example, oil is organic. And that's what they're great at doing. They're the grand decomposers of nature. They break things down into their component parts so that they can absorb it for themselves. They have an external stomach. They send out enzymes. They break things down. So by breaking down organic matter, which is really critical because otherwise we would choke on everything on the planet, it breaks things down so they can be recombined into new life, into new plants.
Wow.
So if you have an oil spill, that's one way it does it. If you have toxic, a toxic spill or heavy metals because of the poisoning of the earth, it will help remediate that because it breaks things down. If we break things down, nature has a way of recombining them into life. Life is a circle and a cycle. And without the fungal network, we wouldn't be able to have that circle. So it's not the end of life. It really is the beginning of life.
Louis Schwartzberg is my guest. His film, Fantastic Fungi, The Magic Beneath Us. He's speaking at this year's TEDxKC event coming up next week. Let's redefine mycelium for people so everyone's on the same page with us here, Louis. What is mycelium?
So mycelium is this, is the organism. It's under the ground. So imagine it's like an apple tree. The tree is under the ground, and the mushrooms are the fruit, like the apple is to a tree. So the organism, the mycelium, is under the ground, and when it needs to reproduce, it'll send up a mushroom. And then the mushroom has spores, and they can travel through the air. Every breath we take, we probably inhale 10 or 15 spores. There's billions of spores out there. So basically, that's the organism that lives under the ground. And again, the mushrooms are the fruit.
And
the
it's not a sexual organ. It's not a vegetable, it's not an animal. It's something else.
Right. It's in between, I guess you might say. There are three major kingdoms, plant, animal, and fungi. And then, according to scientists, we evolved out of fungi. So 2.5 billion years ago, fungi divided and branched off of fungi. It was animals. So it's one of the reasons why they help our immune system, because they are similar to us in their DNA. We're more closely related to fungi than we are to plants. For example, penicillin has saved more human lives than any other medicine in the history of mankind. Mm-hmm. Why is that? They fight the same viruses and bacteria that they need to protect themselves, also protect us.
That's interesting. If our listeners want to join our conversation as we talk about the power and the magic of mushrooms, our phone number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. So if the mycelium grows underground, as you're saying here, Louis, I can only imagine what kind of challenge that poses for a movie director. How do you capture something underground like that?
That is a challenge. But I'm really good at making the invisible visible. I sort of have a history of doing extraordinary time-lapse and slow-mo. I did a 3D IMAX movie for National Geographic that's still out there called Mysteries of the Unseen World, narrated by Forrest Whitaker. So I use, everything from, macro lenses to microscopic cinematography down to even scanning electron microscopy. But when it came to doing like a journey underground and traveling through the mycelium network, that's where I used reference photos and then used computer-generated animation to take people on a journey traveling through the mycelium network from one tree to another.
In looking at some of your work, you're able to show people how we can now photograph things as small as cells, I believe. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that and the kinds of equipment you work with these days to enable you to do something like that.
Well, we use, macro lenses. We use, lenses that are attached to microscopes. And again, as I said earlier, including scanning electron microscopy, that's actually firing electrons at an object, which is smaller than the beam of light, in order to capture an image. And based on those reference photos, we're able to create animation that can really, opened our eyes and broadened our perspective. And I think what's important beyond the technical approach to doing it is that it really is a shift of consciousness, because when you can see things from the point of view of a flower, a hummingbird, a cell that lives under the ground, an amoeba, a nematode, you're realizing that we have a very limited point of view. Our point of view, the human point of view, is a narrow spectrum of light, and you know, we don't see like an eagle can see, and we don't perceive energy the way a flower can do it. But imagine if you could see all that energy from all these different point of views, how it would, you know, shift your consciousness.
You know, I found, you know, a lot of the stuff that you do just a kissing cousin away from breathtaking. I mean, some of that time-lapse photography, you just almost can't believe what you're seeing. And I can't remember if it was in the preview for Fantastic Fungi or something in your previous TED Talk that you gave, where you actually, I can't remember the whole sequence exactly, but you start off with a large object and just gradually moved down the chain until we were looking at, I think, single cells, if I remember correctly. Can you recall what I'm talking about and describe what you did there?
Well, I think that was a power of 10 zoom.
There you go.
From Mysteries of the Unseen World. We actually went from a strand of spider web,
which was 10
times stronger than steel.
Yes.
And
yes.
We did a zoom all the way down to an atom. So that's a power of 10. That's like going farther than from here to the moon in terms of scale, which is, you know, pretty mind-boggling. But again, the benefit of that is, and you say it's breathtaking, then you ask yourself, well, why is it breathtaking or why is it so beautiful? It's because I think we are looking at the divine. You know, we're looking at the magic of the universe. And when you see it, you connect, I think, in a very emotional way, not always in an academic, intellectual way, and it moves you.
I was going to say, what kind of responses have you gotten over the years to this incredible work that you do? I mean, it must be fun being you sometimes as people walk out of one of your films and react to what they've just seen.
Well, a lot of times people are crying.
Yeah, you know? I bet.
And it's not because it's a sad movie. It's because it touches them so deeply. Many people do feel that it's a spiritual experience to be able to look into, you know, the mysteries of the universe. It's got nothing to do with religion. It just has to do with being moved on a spiritual level. In addition, you know, I have a whole series on Netflix called Moving Art, and it's just nothing. It's pure nature and music with no dialogue. And I have hundreds of comments from people who claim that it's a healing modality. Everything from, you know, people who have addiction, people have cancer, post-op, pre-op, people who were suicidal, they claimed it saved them. Now, I've never made a claim that it's going to heal you, but, you know, hundreds of people claims that it healed them. And because of that feedback, I have now begun to introduce it into healthcare. We have it in every room down to brand new hospital at UCSD in La Jolla, and we're bringing it into, like, brain health in Dallas. And we're beginning to collect the data to prove that visual imagery of nature can heal you.
Hmm. I can only begin to imagine the challenges of shooting time-lapse photography and what those challenges represent. What are some of the challenges? I mean, obviously, nothing can move, right? You have to have a really stationary image here.
Well, the bulk of what I film in time-lapse with, you know, flowers, plants, mushrooms, we do interior in the studio. Lots of reasons why. One is you have to have control of the lighting because we shoot day and night. Can't have any wind. Can't have bugs. And I can't have anybody steal my camera if it's sitting out there for 2 weeks or 3 weeks waiting for a mushroom to pop. So it takes a tremendous amount of patience. There is a lot of failure. In terms of, you know, the mushroom pops up and it's out of frame, it's out of focus.
Because you can't predict exactly how far the mushroom's going to pop when it finally does, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, look, nature controls the show. I don't. So, and nature tells the story. So there, as I said, there's a ratio of failure. Maybe I get 1 out of 6. Hmm. As much as I try, and I've been doing this now for 40 years, nonstop, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And in 40 years, I've squeezed 40 years into 16 hours of film.
Oh, my. Yeah. Does it feel like that was worth it, all those 40 years?
Absolutely. I mean, at the rate I'm going, you know, who knows, by the time maybe I leave this planet, I will have 24 hours. So let's just say my entire life got squeezed into one day.
Wow. Wow.
Does that blow your mind?
It does. It does, actually. How long does it take for you to for a mushroom to pop? How long will you be filming that mushroom before you get what you're looking for?
Well, I mean, on average, let's say a mushroom can pop in 2 to 3 days. Some of them might take 2 weeks, 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then you get, you know, let's just say roughly 1 out of 6 might be a good shot. And but again, what I'm able to do is I can light it the way you can't light it in the forest, you know. I can get the detail that I need to get, depth of field, all the cool things of photography and cinematography. And so I'm basically opening a window into nature's intelligence and being able to see things that the human eye can't see. I mean, we can't see things in macro, right? We don't have a magnifying glass in front of our eyeballs. So just even seeing things, the detail in close-up is a portal into a world we can't see, let alone the fact that it's in motion. We don't see it move.
Right.
It moves,
right.
Correct? And so... This is life. This is life that surrounds us and definitely shifts your consciousness, which I think is really important. And Steve, I just want to mention for your viewers, there is also going to be a screening on, I think, the 8th in the movie theater. I don't know if you go to fantasticfungi.com, it will list the theater that it's playing
5 p.m.
in Kansas City.
February 8th at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. For tickets, you can go to the museum's website. How's that, Lewis?
Well, thank you.
Yes.
I just wanted people to know if they couldn't, because I know it's sold out at the TED Talk, but people can see the movie. And what's great about watching the movie on the giant screen is that it's an immersive experience, and we always have a panel discussion afterwards where we bring the local community together, you know, in Kansas City, the mycologists, foragers, chefs, permaculture. We're sort of catalyzing a movement where people are gathering, talking about things they really care about.
Again, that'll be at 5 p.m. on February 8th at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Again, for ticket information, just go to the museum's website. And if you're just joining us, again, I'm talking with Lewis Schwartzberg, who's an icon in the time-lapse photography movement in that world, who's my guest. He's speaking at TEDxKC coming up next week here in town. You know, is the goal of time-lapse photography, Lewis, is it the educational aspect? Is it the wow factor that comes when you watch this thing grow, then explode onto the screen like a flower? What is it?
I think it's all the above.
Yeah.
excuse me. I think that as an artist, I'm into the beauty, and I think that beauty is life force energy, so I just love showing things that are beautiful. On the other hand, to scientists who view my work, they have been inspired because they've seen things that they've never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
So it can also be used as a scientific tool. I'm proud to say that I'm an invention ambassador for the American Association for the Advancement of Science. That's the organization that publishes Nature magazine.
Right.
And I'm probably the only artist that's in this, you know, select group of scientists. So I never really try to make a science film. I've got many, you know, awards for best science movie. I'm not trying to make a science movie. What I am showing is truth.
Mm-hmm.
And in this day and age, I think we're desperate for a little bit of truth.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I'm just showing what's real. And I'm showing you by speeding things up or slowing things down or you know, magnifying things, I'm showing you what's real, yet what the human eye can't see. And again, what I think that does is it makes us more compassionate, more empathetic, more patient,
right,
and more conscious.
Interesting. So what's been your contribution to the world of time-lapse photography?
Well, I pioneered time-lapse photography back in 1974. I was the first person to figure out how to shoot time-lapse in 35 millimeter.
Oh, that's interesting.
Prior to that, they had been shot in 16 millimeter. And again, for scientific analysis, they take a plant, they would put like a grid behind it and go, oh my God, look, the plant can move, the plant can grow. And so it was used for a tool of analysis starting in the 1930s. But I wanted to use it as an art form. And what happened is by doing the time-lapse, lo and behold, I also pioneered the contemporary stock library business because the ad agencies started to see my work and they started to license it for commercials. Hmm. If you recall, like Heartbeat of America,
right.
streaking traffic of cars, many banks would use my imagery of time-lapse to say, hey, you know, trust us. We're, you know, Prudential, Merrill Lynch, you name it, because the power of nature is something that you can trust. So it's eye candy, right? In mm-hmm. 2 seconds, you can grab someone's attention. And so I turned it into a new form of visual vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
And now we see time lapse all the time in commercials and TV shows. And it doesn't, you know, strike you as being totally, you know, unique or unusual. We sort of accept it now as part of our grammar,
right,
our visual
right,
grammar.
Right.
But prior to me shooting it in 35 millimeter, nobody had done it. And that's
wow.
because there were no cameras around who could shoot time-lapse. So I took these old, old movie cameras because time-lapse was, or single-frame cinematography was used primarily to shoot animation like a Disney cartoon, right? Had a big AC motor. A friend of mine made electric guitars for The Grateful Dead. He built a motor that ran on batteries. Wow. Now I could take the camera outdoors and shoot one frame at a time.
Yeah.
That was a major breakthrough. And 30 years later, somebody manufactured a DC-powered motor and got an Academy Award for technical achievement. So seeing things in that frame of mind, again, inspires wonder. And wonder takes you to the heart of the divine. It creates, I think, a spiritual transformational experience.
That's Lewis Schwartzberg, again, a director screening of his film Fantastic Fungi, a perfect score on Rotten Tomatoes, followed by a conversation with Lewis will take place at 5 o'clock in the afternoon on February 8th at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Again, tickets, just go to the museum's website. Lewis, what a pleasure to have you. Thanks for taking the time, and we'll look forward to seeing you here in Kansas City.
Absolutely. Thank you, Steve. And I do love Kansas City.
Great, Lewis.
Go Chiefs.
You bet. Absolutely. Thanks so much. On Monday, we'll break down, speaking of the Chiefs, Sunday Super Bowl game, and hopefully what contributed to that big Chiefs victory. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Yesterday on the show, our first ever host-to-host conversation with KQED's Michael Krasny on housing, immigration, and, of course, football in San Francisco. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Our music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Maria Carter, Linda Scheer, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Chelsea Angstrom. Go Chiefs! Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.